You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, this year marks the 20th anniversary of the implementation of the Amber Alert program for missing children in Wisconsin. But in recent years, discussions have arisen about whether the criteria for the alerts might be too restrictive. We'll talk to an administrator for the National Amber Alert program about how effective the alerts are and what those criteria involve. But first, a Wisconsin senator is with us to talk about the possibility of changing the requirements for issuing an Amber Alert or introducing a new type of missing child alert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you see an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert pop up on your phone or your TV, does it work for you? What's your reaction? Does it influence you to keep an eye out? Have you ever called in with a tip, or have you opted out of those alerts? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. State Senator LaTanya Johnson has represented the 6th Senate District in Milwaukee since 2017. Before that, she served in the State Assembly. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the why, I'm curious about the what. As I understand it, this is not a proposal in a bill form yet, but what kind of ideas are you exploring when it comes to missing child alerts?
Well, what we're thinking about exploring is extending the Silver Alert. Right now, we have a Silver Alert for missing senior citizens, and we want to add a children's portion to that. It would be easier for us to add a system and use already existing infrastructure than it would be to create something totally new. And what we're thinking about is to provide services for children under the age of 17, children with mental illness, intellectual disabilities, a child with any type of disability that might prevent them from returning home safely, but also for children under 10 who we know aren't basically self-sufficient on their own. And it becomes critical to find those missing children.
And what has you thinking about these changes right now?
Well, Prince McCree, the 5-year-old that was found deceased, lived 5 houses from me. So I had the opportunity to be with the family when they were searching for Prince. The major frustration for this family was having him not qualify for an Amber Alert. I know that the Milwaukee Police Department tried on 2 different occasions to get an Amber Alert issued, and he didn't meet the criteria. And the reason he didn't meet the criteria was because they didn't have a suspect, either a description of a suspect or a suspect's vehicle. Because the Amber Alert is for abducted children. Now, in the city of Milwaukee, we do have a critical missing child alert, but that only goes out to broadcast, TV and radio. We had neighbors on our block who found out that Prince was found deceased before they even knew that he was missing.
Now, the criminal complaint from the Milwaukee Police Department states that officers came to the home after Prince's mother called 911. They did discover blood and other signs of a murder. And this is a really heartbreaking case, but evidence points to the fact that Prince was killed in the home and his body was moved before his mother woke up and realized he was missing. And in that instance, an Amber Alert wouldn't have necessarily helped save his life. Do you still look to that as a reason to pursue changes?
Yes, because the reality is that there are going to be other children who come up missing. And so just seeing the frustration from Prince's family. Now, if Milwaukee Police Department requested an Amber Alert twice, they had been in that house. They saw the blood. They knew how urgent it was to find this child. And for them to request an Amber Alert and then to know that the child was either severely hurt or in imminent danger, and they still couldn't get one issued, it shows that the Amber Alert doesn't work for every child and every situation. So what we want to do, we want to bridge that gap between abducted children and children who are missing. And the reality is that very seldomly do people get to witness an abduction or even have a suspect available. We need to find something that will allow them to search for missing children in general. The Silver Alert does a 5-mile notification on people's cell phone. It pings. We need the cell phone notification because the reality is not everybody's around a television or a radio. Some people are at work. I live down the street from a firefighter who came home on the day that Prince was found deceased. He didn't even know that Prince was missing because he was at work. And so we want to make sure that everybody, especially in the case of a missing child, especially in the case of a missing 5-year-old, has that opportunity to return home safely. And right now, the Amber Alert doesn't qualify for every child.
Talking to State Senator LaTanya Johnson about changes she'd like to see to missing child alerts in Wisconsin. And Senator Johnson, are there other areas, other states that do something similar to what you're proposing, kind of adding on to the Silver Alert system?
Yes, Indiana is one of the states that has a modification to the Silver Alert. And we also have, I believe, Delaware. They also have modifications as well to the Silver Alert. So we have models to follow in other states. The thing that we have to do now is work with the Department of Justice, basically to make sure that when we do create this system, that we create it as much as possible, working as closely as possible with the Department of Justice, because we want it to work for them too, as well as work for the missing child. But I think to just say, you know, we have systems in place and no other system is needed, that's not true. That's not correct. Because if a 5-year-old didn't qualify for an alert system that would have alerted everybody, his neighbors, then who would? I'm really proud of my community. We had neighbors who put that, you know, Prince was missing on Ring and on Nextdoor. We had other members who put it, you know, on Facebook. But the reality is it still did not touch the magnitude of people that it needed to touch. And for the next child that goes missing, we want to bring them home safely.
Now, there are a lot more children that are reported as missing then do get Amber Alerts in a given year. And I know that Milwaukee, you know, has a lot of those. Prince's case aside, are there other cases that you've seen in your city that kind of like point to the need for this?
Well, not necessarily in the city, but the Lily Peterson case. An Amber Alert was requested for her too, and one wasn't issued because she did not meet the criteria. Since 2003, Wisconsin has seen 57 Amber Alerts from 2003 to May 2023. That shows you how few Amber Alerts get issued. And that's a problem because clearly we have hundreds upon hundreds of kids that go missing in this state. And so it just shows that the bar is too high and we have a gap that a lot of children fall through the cracks.
And what is the timeline you're looking at in terms of getting some legislation drafted and circulating it for support?
We are hoping to have everything drafted by the middle or the end of December. We are working on this legislation with lightning speed. Like I said, I do want the cooperation of the Department of Justice, but the reality is that we are going to introduce this legislation anyway, because as a legislature, standing there by Prince's family, seeing and hearing the police actually make those requests and be denied was unacceptable. It was unacceptable for Prince's family, and it'll be unacceptable for any other parent who has to go through that.
Well, Senator Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
State Senator LaTanya Johnson represents Wisconsin's 6th Senate District in Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about changes she's proposing to Wisconsin's missing child alert system. Coming up next, a national Amber Alert expert talks with us about how effective the alerts are and the reasoning behind the criteria for issuing alert. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should loosen the requirements for issuing some kind of alert for a missing child? Should we have a new type of alert, something built onto existing systems? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the Amber Alert System, potential changes, and how it works in Wisconsin and around the country. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Janelle Rasmussen joins us now, the National Amber Alert Program Administrator at the National Criminal Justice Training Center at Fox Valley Technical College. Janelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious to find out a bit more about how the system works. Someone notices their child is missing. They report it to local police. Where does that information go from there? Who decides whether an Amber Alert is going to be issued?
Sure. Well, the programs work a little bit differently in each of the states. So at the national level, we provide a recommended criteria and procedures for state to use. It's a federally recommended criteria. And from there, each of the states establish their own Amber Alert programs and put together criteria that is relevant to the work that they're doing in their individual states, the resources that they have available, and the types of cases that they have. The recommended criteria that we have is that a missing person is a child and that they're under the age of 18, that the police have reason to believe that the child has been abducted, that they have information to put out to the public that may be the child's information or it could be the suspect or vehicle information. And then we must have reason to believe that the child is in serious danger. And that information is important for us to make this Amber Alert happen.
And what's the reasoning behind some of those requirements, particularly having information about the suspect and the suspect's vehicle? Why are those in there?
Absolutely. Well, we know that when a child is abducted, that time is of the essence. In most cases, when a child is harmed, it's done within the first 3 hours of being abducted. So we want that information to get out very quickly to the public, and we want the public's help in locating that abducted child. And so the more information that we have and that we're able to put out to the public, the more likely that we're going to be able to recover that child. For the vehicle information, it's important if we're going to utilize the road signs that we have information on a vehicle to put up there. It doesn't always have to be the case. In some states, they do not require vehicle information in order to issue an Amber Alert. And same with the suspect information. It varies from state. Just some sort of information to put out on that child.
And the program is in its 20th year here in Wisconsin. What do we know about how effective Amber Alerts have been at locating missing children?
We know Amber Alert is very effective. To date, we've had 1,146 kids returned home just because an Amber Alert was issued, whether they were directly recovered because somebody saw that child, suspect, or vehicle and contacted law enforcement. They did so because an Amber Alert was issued and those kids are home or were recovered safely because of that alert. So it's very successful. But not just that, it's also a deterrent. We've had cases where a child has been abducted and that abductor is driving down the highway with that child in the car, gets an alert on their phone, sees it on the roadside, pulls over and drops off that child because they know that when an Amber Alert is issued, everybody is looking for that missing child.
And earlier we heard State Senator LaTanya Johnson talking about how she'd like to see some of the requirements for those alerts loosened up or having a missing child alert added onto our silver alert system. What do you think about those ideas of making it easier to issue an Amber Alert?
Yeah, I think that it's really important that Amber Alerts are reserved for cases that meet the criteria. We do not want to desensitize the system by sending out hundreds of alerts or sending them out too frequently when we have cases that don't meet that criteria. And a lot of people describe it as the car alarm syndrome, where you walk by and a car alarm is going off and you don't pay attention. We want people to know that when an Amber Alert is issued, this is exactly what we're looking for and we need your assistance. But it is critical that we have systems in place that are used for other types of cases. So if there is a child that is missing, and we can't confirm it's been a child abduction, but we do know that that child is still missing, and based on their age, they may be in danger, we want to have a system available for them. So we encourage states to have a secondary system called an endangered missing person alert, where they can send out alerts to the media and ask for their help in broadcasting that information to look for that missing child, that missing adult, or somebody who may be missing and in need of medical attention. So we do encourage states to have a secondary system in place and send out that information, because any child who is missing is endangered.
We have time for one quick call. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm 69 years old, and I don't have any children. And I can see how the Amber Alert can be helpful. But I think when you really boil it down, I read articles after the fact in the newspaper how it's usually irresponsible parents. And I really think these people should pay for the Amber Alert system if it's been used.
Mike, thanks for the call. Sorry we don't have a lot of time. Janelle, again, these are alerts that are issued when the standard is pretty high in our last 30 seconds or so. Oh, Janelle, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. And just a reminder that the standards are pretty high for an Amber Alert being issued, correct?
Absolutely. The criteria is very strict, and we do, you know, encourage the states to establish their own criteria, because it needs to be what works best within the states. But we certainly create an opportunity for this criteria to go across the border. I think it's important to remember that when a child is abducted too, you can go from Wisconsin into Minnesota pretty quickly. And if there is a case like that, Wisconsin can reach out to their border states and they can request an Amber Alert in that border state. But the criteria has to be pretty similar, and it is across the state lines, so that you can make that request if an abducted child does travel into another state.
Well, Janelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Janelle Rasmussen is the National Amber Alert Program Administrator at the National Criminal Justice Training Center at Fox Valley Technical College. She talked with us about how Amber Alerts work in Wisconsin and what options are out there for missing child cases that don't necessarily meet the Amber Alert criteria. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from the podcast Humanity Unlocked, which focuses on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin.
Tattoos can tell the story of a person's life. They feature aesthetic beauty, inside jokes, or family memories. Some of Daniel Schleicher's tattoos memorialize his favorite people. His story comes to us from the Odyssey Beyond Bars project, which provides classes for students incarcerated in Wisconsin.
I'm a little nervous, I ain't gonna lie to y'all. So bear with me. All right, so my story's called Penguins, Bears, and Tattoos, Oh My. When I was a kid, I looked up to Kenny. I wished he was my dad. He wasn't. Kenny was, in fact, my two older sisters' dad. I remember him coming over to our house to pick up my sisters for his weekend to have them. I never understood why I couldn't go with them. It was clear I was a likable kid, how he played basketball with me while waiting for them to get ready, which felt like forever. Yet it was probably just minutes. In those moments of shooting hoops, I would even pretend he was my dad, but Kenny wasn't my dad. He wasn't my stepdad. He was, however, a father figure, and I honor him today in calling him my bonus dad. I only wish I could have told him this, for those moments spent with him meant a lot to me. You see, Kenny passed away in 1994, and what he doesn't know is he played such an important part of my life and had a role in my love for tattoos. He had several himself, and the only one I remember was a tattoo of a penguin on his hand. So to a boy looking up to this man, I just thought this was what men do, is get tattoos. I got my first tattoo at the age of 13 in a friend's garage. It was a nickname friends called me back then, and it was difficult to hide from my mother. And now that I'm older, several tattoos later, it's still getting difficult to hide them from my mother. I never had a scheme to my madness of tattoos other than if I wanted something somewhere, I got it. I'm tattooed literally head to toe. I can't say I have a favorite. I have some I want to cover and many more I want to get. I do, however, have some that got me through some dark times with just a glance, like my children's names on my fingers that I see every moment of the day. There's my mother's name on my arm, as she's been the strength and my unconditional love. I have my granddaughter's handprint over my heart because she's a piece of my heart in human form. And I have my last name, Schleicher, which is Kenny's last name, that I carry on for him. I also have a rose tattoo for him with Rest in Peace Kenneth and the date he passed. And yet my mind comes back to that penguin tattoo. That tattoo created a love for penguins that runs so deep, I customized my own penguin stuffed animals for my kids and granddaughter when I was in Columbia Correctional Institute. I used to work for the Incel Teddy Bear Project, and that's where I had the opportunity to do so. I've drawn cards and pictures of penguins for them. And when I did beadwork, I made those tiny penguins that fit on the tops of pens, and their little arms would flop all upside down with each pen stroke. That's not where my love stops. I had penguins looked up to discover that they only mate once in their lifetime, and on an occasion, if the mate dies, they will move on. The male even goes as far to find a pebble or a rock, like a diamond, that he kicks around until he presents it to the female. If that is not a true love story for you, then I don't know what is. I decided I'd like to get a penguin tattoo in memory of Kenny. I wanted the exact tattoo or close to, so I wrote home asking for photos of these in order to draw it. That's when I discovered my whole life was a lie, that Kenny did not have a penguin tattoo on his hand like I remembered. He had, in fact, a bear tattoo, and not just any bear, but the Ham's Bear from Ham's Beer. Okay, in all fairness, this was over 30 years ago, and I only had minutes with the man, and the ink back then was not a good quality. So this tattoo was mistaken as a penguin. You can see it. Yeah. Now you know how I feel. Now I have to get this Ham's Bear tattoo in memory of Kenneth Schleicher, and I still want to get a penguin tattooed for the moments he shared and what that meant to a boy just wanting a father, something I never got to tell him. Thank you.
That story about tattoos came from Daniel Schleicher while he was incarcerated in Oregon, Wisconsin. His story is featured in the newest season of the human-powered podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Packers legend and Lambeau Leap inventor Leroy Butler joins the show. He'll talk about his career and answer some questions about the Packers submitted by 8th graders. That's tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show. How many people do you know? It might take a while to count them out, but researchers at the University of Washington have arrived at an estimate. The average person knows 611 people. Now, someone you know, by their measure, is someone you recognize by sight, know how to contact, and have had some kind of interaction with in the last 2 years. They reach their number by starting small. For example, asking people how many Marias they knew or how many construction workers. Knowing what percentage of Marias make up the U.S. population then helped extrapolate someone's overall acquaintances. Those numbers aren't perfect. Look, I like to socialize, but frankly, 611 people sounds like a lot to handle. Fortunately, the response for how many close friends we have is more manageable, about 2 to 3. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, what we know today as family court started more than 100 years ago as juvenile court. It was a progressive reform referred to as the Great Idea. In the years since, the scope of that system has grown a lot. Today, having a hand in the foster system, custody disputes, child protection, and more. It affects millions of people, but has largely escaped scrutiny. Our next guest says the system is doing more harm for families than good, and it needs to be replaced with something else. We want to hear from you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been involved with family court for juvenile justice, foster care, adoption, or something else? What was the experience like? What do you think needs to change? And do you work in the family court system? If so, what do you see working and what's not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. Her new book is called The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Can you bring us back to the beginning when the idea was juvenile court? What was that system meant to address when it started?
The juvenile court began at the beginning of the 20th century, actually 1899 in Chicago, where the first court was founded. And the idea of the court was that a benevolent judge, using informality and a lot of discretion, would help families and help children, so-called fix them, in a social court. So a place that really didn't have much due process. The judge and maybe a probation officer or a social worker would try to figure out why a child was getting into trouble or why a family couldn't take care of their children and try to problem solve, try to fix what was wrong. I think it's important to recognize that at the time this was going on in the major cities of the Northeast and the Midwest, where millions of immigrants, most of them impoverished, were flooding into the cities. And so the families that the court intended to fix were not the earlier white settlers, but these immigrants who came from Southern and Eastern Europe, had very different customs, culture, language, approaches to life, and were deeply impoverished. And so many of the reformers believed that what they needed was to be made into, quote, proper Americans, and saw the court as one of the ways to do that, particularly when things were particularly bad for a family. So some of the ideas that the reformers had, like kindergartens and libraries and settlement houses, all had quite a positive spin to them. But the juvenile court, though it was set up to fix them, was often seen by the immigrants as punitive.
And how do we get from the point where it was a juvenile court system to what it is now, handling so much of family business and family life? How does it change into family court?
Well, it takes almost a century to do that. At the beginning, the kinds of cases that came into the family court were not so different than the kinds that come in today. The difference really was that the court itself didn't see a difference. So when children might have broken the law, what we call juvenile delinquency, when children get into trouble, but they haven't really broken the law, they've just misbehaved, and because they are under 18, they can still be brought to court. That was part of delinquency at the beginning, and now it is a separate category of young people called status offenses. The status is their age. And then what was called then dependency, and we now call neglect and abuse. So the court dealt with those kinds of issues and also dealt with issues concerning custody, paternity, support. And over time, as these different areas of law became categorized separately and different causes of action, the court continued to expand so that today it encompasses, in most jurisdictions, all of those issues. In some jurisdictions, also divorce and other matrimonial issues.
And you mentioned something earlier, due process. And I was really surprised to read in your book that in the early years of juvenile court, family court, it was acknowledged by some that due process wasn't really compatible with what they were trying to do. Can you talk about that idea of due process and what it's looked like over the years in the court?
Sure. There was no due process in the early court. The whole idea was that either the child or the parent was exchanging this benevolent help for what would otherwise be, at the time, due process in another court. Over the course of the century, as people began to recognize that this court was not achieving what it was supposed to be achieving, which was to diminish juvenile delinquency and recidivism, help families. And when it wasn't doing that in that way, there was much more concern that this bargain that had been made was not really occurring, and that maybe young people and their families needed more due process. By the 1960s, when the Supreme Court was really looking hard at due process for both adults and young people, it began to scrutinize the juvenile court a great deal. And the classic example of that is a case called In re Gault, where a young child, really a 14-year-old, Gerald Gault, allegedly made a lewd phone call without any due process, not a lawyer, not witnesses, not even notice of what the charges were. He got sent to the Arizona Reform School for 6 years. Fortunately, there was an ACLU lawyer in Arizona in the 1960s who got the ACLU to take that all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, Justice Fortas in particular, really railed at this court for providing young people with absolutely no chance to prove that they had not done what they had been charged with doing, and that essentially the court was the worst of both worlds. It was neither benevolent nor was it providing due process. So that was the beginning of what came to be called fundamental fairness in juvenile court and later in the expanded family court, where young people were given many more, though not quite all, the due process rights that adults had. Unfortunately, while that is what was supposed to happen, as recently as during the Obama administration, there were many studies done by the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, finding that many juvenile and family courts remain stuck in the pre-Gault era, giving very little due process to young people, and really almost forgetting that that was their obligation. And so many jurisdictions ended up coming under federal mandates to provide counsel to young people, to make sure they had the rights they're supposed to have. And these were only in places where the administration saw very clearly what the problems were. But there are many places around the country where this continues.
We're talking with Jane M. Spinnick right now, a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School, talking about her new book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. You can join in, too, with your questions, your comments, your experiences with the family court system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Jane M. Spinnick from Columbia Law School about her new book, The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. And Jane, you write in the book that when you started in on this book, you didn't think about, you didn't plan on saying that the court should be abolished. Where did you start to change your mind? What is it about the family court system that you think needs doing away with?
Well, you're right. When I started, I really did believe that the court could be made into a better version of itself. I kept thinking that with less discretion for the judges and more due process, maybe it could work well. There were a few things that changed my mind. The first was digging down into the history of the court over about 125 years now, and seeing that the kinds of problems we face in the court today are the same kinds of problems that were faced throughout the history, often with the same solutions proposed and then rejected. So it has always been a court for poor people. It increasingly became a court disproportionately for people of color, especially Black, and later in the century, Native Americans. And early on, really very early on, even supporters of the court, but often also scholars outside of the court, began identifying that many of the issues that the families had could be solved in their communities, that they did not have to be brought into court, that so much of what brought them into court was their poverty, the segregated communities they lived in, the lack of housing, of proper child care, of good schools, many of the same things we say today. But those concerns were consistently answered by the court itself, especially the judges, as, well, society's never going to do that, so they're better off coming into court. And if you just give us some more resources and you give us more judges, we'll fix those problems. But the truth is, the court has never been able to do that. The suggestion that more resources and more judges would make a difference has been proven wrong over and over again through this century. There were lots more resources and lots more judges, and it hasn't helped the families. It has really drawn out from the community resources that might have made a difference if the community could themselves have helped to develop the kinds of supports and mutual aid that could support families when they especially needed it. The other thing that really changed my perspective was in the last two decades, there has been an increasing advocacy by impacted families and youth, parents and young people with lived experience in the juvenile legal system, in the family regulation, what most people think of as the child welfare system, within the foster care system. There has been a lot of speaking out about the harm that has been caused to generations of families involved in these systems. And that advocacy has really helped me see my role as a professional in the system differently, as someone who really needs to listen hard to what these families are saying. And that has come kind of hand in hand with the idea that abolition is not just about tearing down or, you know, letting people out of prison. Abolition is really a mindset about how we can support people better in ways that have not proven to be so punitive. How can we keep children safe in their families by supporting them in their communities? So all of those things came together for me, and it led me to look really hard at how this court could be shrunk and eventually eliminated so that the only cases that should be in court are those that are really legal cases. So, for example, I think it's important for your listeners to know that only about 20% of any of the cases that ultimately reach the family court in child protection are about serious harms to children, whether they're physical or sexual or, you know, extreme neglect like starvation or the failure to give essential medical care. Everything else is either about poverty or other structural inequalities. So we investigate millions of children every year, and yet only about 500,000 of them ever even reach the family court. But those investigations, which are mostly screened out, are very disruptive to families and end up treating families in ways that make families unwilling to seek help, because they are so afraid of being reported. Even if those reports never become cases in a court, they undermine the ability of parents or young people to trust people like their teachers, like their doctors, like their healthcare workers. And so we actually undermine helping families by having a massive system that doesn't actually keep children safe or keep them happy and healthy in their families.
It is a massive system. One stat that you wrote about that really drove it home for me was that 1 in 3 children nationwide and over half of Black children will experience a child protection investigation by the time they reach 18 years old. I mean, that's a pretty stark number.
It's a ridiculous number. And as I just was discussing, most of those investigations are terribly disruptive. They scare people, of course, but most of them don't end up in finally reaching the court. And so, nor do they end up with providing the services that these families need. And yet we spend about, at last count, about $34 billion on these systems, almost half of which goes for out-of-home care for those numbers of children who eventually reach court and are placed away from their families. Mm-hmm. If we took that $15 billion and spread it around in communities, it is much more likely that children will be safe within their families. Because as we found during the worst of the pandemic, when impoverished families get more money and they don't have to worry as much about evictions, and they get some mutual aid from their communities, there was less findings of abuse and neglect during that period of time.
Yeah, I am curious, Jane, sorry to interrupt, but in our last minute or so here, if the court would be shrunken, would be done away with, what do you imagine kind of taking its place?
Well, the biggest thing that will take its place is community-based services, where most people can get the supports they need, whether it's substance use treatment, mental health, regular health treatment, better funded schools, all of these things would make a huge difference. For those small number of cases that still have a legal issue that we want people to have due process for, they can be part of our current judicial system without having a separate court that still believes it's doing good. At least the other courts in the system recognize that at best they're doing some justice, but they're not pretending that they're doing good.
Well, Jane, thanks for sharing this with us today and taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. We've been talking with her about her new book, The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the railroads were a big part of Wisconsin's growth as a state. Today, some old rail lines carry hikers and bikers instead of trains. We'll learn more about the history of railroads in the state and the birth of the rails to trails movement here. Plus, ice used to be a valuable commodity in Wisconsin. An author shares her book about how ice and refrigeration changed our lives and tells the story of the Great Lakes Ice Wars. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a longtime journalist shares her thoughts about how the media should do better at covering the possibility of a second Donald Trump presidency. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.